What is your killer strategy? The one that gives your business the ultimate bulletproof competitive advantage. Welcome to Your Advantage Play with your host, Joel Block. Former professional blackjack player and card counter who left Las Vegas and spent his life in that giant casino on Wall Street in the hedge fund and venture capital businesses. And now, here's your host, Joel Block.
Cancer is one of the most scary diagnoses that a patient can receive. And that diagnosis is dished out more than 1.9 million times a year in the United States alone, with over 600,000 deaths. Clearly, bad numbers and a scary, huge problem, but an opportunity for a pharmaceutical company like our guests. This company is developing an innovative approach to curing this terrible disease, and it has great upside, but the downside risk is dramatic as well. How then does such an innovative company manage and mitigate these risks? To answer those questions, James Nathaniels. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Hey, good to have you. First of all, thank you for working on this terrible problem. This is a problem that worldwide is just awful. And people say cancer sucks, and it does. And anybody who's had to go through this problem, it's terrible. So tell us first, why are you doing this? Was this a family thing, or is this just an opportunity thing? I mean, what's the reason you're doing this?
Well, first and foremost, it's a combination of opportunity and circumstances. But as you progress, those opportunities and circumstances can only go so far. It's really about what motivates you. And for me personally, it's about legacy. So one day, I hope that if this drug treats patients and if it's good enough, get it to as many patients as possible. And that means someone's father, mother, son or daughter can have their life extended meaningfully with a better quality of life. Then I know I've served my purpose well. That's my goal.
Listen, it's noble and it's necessary, and I hope that you're successful. So tell us, what is it that you're working on?
I'm working on an enzyme treatment for metastatic cancer from solid tumors. And this treatment or this technology has been around for nearly 100 years, but no one at present has taken it to the length and breadth that we have in pharmaceutical drug development and testing it in proper controlled clinical studies, see if this drug can know what it can do, and then if it's successful, get it to the market and distribute it.
Now, you're a small company, right?
Yes.
And I imagine you have limited resources. How is it that you guys are working on this and it's not being developed by one of the major pharmaceutical companies? How is it that you find yourself in this place in general? How did that happen?
Great question. So it's a combination of the fact that nearly 100 years ago, this science was developed and came to light. And then for various reasons, it fell out of favor by the medical establishment. It was then used by the integrated medicine side, but a lack of understanding of tumor biology meant that this drug had mixed results. So if anybody searches the use of enzymes, it's understood relatively, but never taken through to the level that we have. In terms of big pharma companies looking to develop these technologies, this drug was selected by us because of its scientific rationale, because of the evidence supporting the idea that enzymes can stop cancer from spreading. However, the technical challenges, even simply getting a patent, something that's naturally derived, but also been around and being used for nearly 100 years, was going to present a challenge, as well as the technical difficulty in creating a product that could have a reasonable shelf life, be used in a uniform manner according to the pharmaceutical standards that are required to get a drug approved worldwide. So these were the technical challenges behind it, But we chose it fundamentally because we believe it works.
And just for clarity, because most of the people that listen to the show are not technical people. They're executives and like that, but they're not technical, I imagine, in your field, or maybe only a small number might be. We're talking about you're developing a drug. Would this be an injectable drug? Would it be a mouth drug, an oral drug? I mean, what are we talking about?
Initially, it'll be an injectable. And there's a very specific reason why that's the case. Firstly, you can make sure of patient compliance, that the drug indeed has gone into the body. And then secondly, from a regulatory standpoint, that you get the maximum exposure of your drug to the cancer site. So in other words, we plan to inject intravenously in patients once weekly to see the effects, because in a controlled clinical trial setting, you want to make sure you maximize the performance of that drug and know that you're getting 100% of the drug into the body, and therefore you can see the effects it has on the patient.
Let's talk for a second about marketing these drugs. Let's say you came up with something that really worked. I would imagine that there are some big companies, for selfish reasons, that would like to not see you be successful. Just unfortunately, that's how it works. So how do you get doctors to find out about this drug if they're already being serviced by a drug manufacturer that's got a mediocre solution and yours is better?
Yep. Great question. Firstly, everybody acknowledges cancer is still a space that is largely underserved. A patient receiving general standard therapies or standard treatment approaches may have an extension of life, but ultimately a cure is still a long way off for many cancers, unfortunately. But there is a well-known, established need out there for new drugs, new modes of action. The challenges the pharmaceutical companies have is that they're so diverse in what they're invested in that any new novel approach that's out of the box, they are risk averse and they will want to wait to see the body of evidence supporting that this drug can do what it says it will do.
Yeah.
Because they have the money to pay for it.
And I imagine there's probably some liability on somebody if a doctor dispenses this drug and it doesn't work very well or doesn't do as planned. I imagine there could be problems.
Yes, that's why you go through the proper controlled clinical studies for that very reason, because the regulators are there to protect the public interests. But because of the dire need of new drugs, physicians and specialists are aware, have a high degree of awareness about what drugs are coming through clinical trials, especially new ones with new modes of action that may be more effective, less toxic. Now, our drug is also extra out of the ordinary, extraordinary, because the toxicity is far less. So the risks associated with our drug compared to standard treatment approaches, know the effects, immunosuppression, hair loss, nausea, loss of quality of life. These drugs are very toxic. So if something comes out that's less toxic, that could be part of the treatment process, not replacing these other products, I think it's going to be a win-win situation for companies that are looking for new drugs and their physicians.
You know, I would imagine that a small company like yours doesn't end up being the one that manufactures it, dispenses it, you know. So what happens to your company? So you develop this, you find out it's successful, you get it through the trials, the FDA and all the international bodies sign off on it. What happens? Is somebody going to come make an offer to buy your company, or do you license the drug? I mean, what, you know, because you're not in the manufacturing business, that's a whole different business. And by the way, and then distribution is a whole other thing. And maybe if they owned it, they might be more interested in putting it to the front of the line.
Well, we have a strategy that's at the moment. Our enzyme treatment is actually readily available from a natural source. So our enzymes are actually coming from cattle, from the pancreas, and they're extracted through a raw material supply that we're able to already obtain commercial quantities. So a lot of new drugs out there, normally millions are spent before you even know that drug is readily available as a commercial supply. But we know we have it. We're already, to an extent, vertically integrated with our supplier. And what we intend to do is work with them to have that commercial capacity in the longer term. Now, once we get our drug to, say, proof of concept in patients, the potential may be that we could license the drug, as you just mentioned. However, there is the possibility and the distinct possibility that if the results are good enough, and as we believe, we think that we can, then there may be the possibility of what they call fast-track designation, where a drug can be accelerated through to approval so long as you continue to monitor the drug once it's approved for use. Now, in that case, all we would need to do is find a distributor for that drug, as you mentioned. We're not necessarily strategically looking to distribute the drug ourselves, but the possibility may be that down the track, we could vertically integrate because of that raw material supply to essentially step back and work towards ultimately becoming a manufacturer of that raw material one day in the future.
So you think that you guys are going to be able to hang on that long, that you'll be able to get it through the trials and then produce it and get it into the hands of a distributor and stay involved?
There is that potential, but strategically, it might make sense to accelerate it by partnering the drug. So as soon as we enter into our first clinical trial, 3 months in, we get some results, we're going to be speaking to potential partners. I already have an interest from an oncology company, a biopharmaceutical company with 50,000 employees, that said when we have the human data available, they would like to see it. We also sought an opinion of another big pharma company a few years back. We were at an earlier stage. They said if we can get this drug through the technical hurdles and challenges that they foresee, he said they will be kicking the door down because such is the need for new drugs that have alternative mechanisms of action that are less toxic but more effective. And the only way you can find that out is to head into patients in a proper.
So you guys are raising money, I imagine, right? You're probably constantly raising money.
Continually.
Yeah.
We're a pre-revenue company, and that's the biggest risk, financial risk.
Yeah. So we'll get to that in a couple of minutes. But so investors need to know what your long-term plan is. So if they come into your company, they wonder, how are you going to get out of this deal?
And, of course.
You know, is there, I guess there'd be public shares that would, they could trade their shares, but the plan, the short-term plan is really, I mean, you'll take a look at it later, but what I'm hearing you say is that you're intending to hang in there and take it as far as you can.
As far as I can, but the key to it is the financial resourcing of the company. And so the challenge is that we're continually raising money as a pre-revenue development stage company.
Yeah.
But what we did was we took a global view. We've actually been public since 2012. But here's the interesting point. A lot of companies in that early stage would have reverse merged onto the bulletin board, as they used to call it. But what we did was we were fully audited from inception, never a shell, and we went through the whole SEC registration statement process, and we even registered shares at the time. So it was like a silent list, almost like a mini IPO. We did that because we took a global view that we wanted to access hedge fund money in the United States to get our drug through the various milestones. Since inception, we've raised $23 million US. Now, there's some NASDAQ companies that haven't raised that money. On the OTC, it comes at a cost, and we acknowledge that. But we're at the point, we're looking for our Series A financing. We're at the stage where the next round of money gets us into these clinical trials. And that's the exciting part for us. But of course, there's been seismic shifts in the last 15 years since my company's formed way back in 2007, the global financial downturn, the global pandemic situation, and the way you do business has continually changed, and the way you seek investment also has to continually change. And it's taken me a little while over the course of the pandemic, being in Melbourne, Australia. We were isolated from the rest of the world. We were the longest city under lockdown. What we're understanding now is that to get in front of whether it's investment bankers, the financiers, the investors, You need to create an awareness of your company. You need to market your stock. You need to market your story and regenerate that interest. A lot of people are now virtual. You've got to think on your feet, be more mobile. Before, it used to take a phone call, two or three conversations, and maybe you're in the door. Now, the understanding is it may take 8 active investor engagements before you get to that point of raising the money you need. Now, armed with that information, I'm now working and engaging with advisors that can assist me in that process.
So these funds, these larger groups that are coming into your deal, are they buying liquid shares that they can trade away if they don't want them anymore? Or are they putting money in some other way?
The frank response to that is, at the moment, as a microcap company, we're largely relying on retail investors that are buying the stock, seeing the story, understanding what we're trying to achieve. With this Series A, we're looking to consider, as part of that, an uplist to an exchange like the NASDAQ. So that will automatically create a much better potential for value generation for those shareholders that are in for the long term.
So tell us, if an investor comes in with $10 million, they're not going to buy them at the market price. They're going to buy them for some other price. How do they come in? Are they preferred? Are they securitized? What kind of shares? What are you selling these guys when they come in?
So that's something that we would look to flesh out with investors, because we've spent $23 million on development. We have 87 patents. We have multiple scientific publications that have published all our data. We even have prior human experience with our drug. It completely changes the probability and risk factors of achieving success in clinical trials, which I know would interest you as a former professional card player. You're changing the numbers, so to speak. But when it comes to the structuring of the financing, we'll have a flexible arrangement with the investors. We'll understand that perhaps it's a convertible preferred, but it's in equity. Perhaps there's warrants as well. So there's many different ways you can structure it based on the discussions and the negotiations. But what we would look to do is create a win-win situation that recognizes the company's value is presently unlocked. The market has yet to understand what our real value is of our company. As we move forward through our milestones in the near term, we think we'll be able to unlock significant value.
So and a whole other question I always like to ask young companies who are small but yet public. Why did you go public, and are you getting some value from being public? Because, you know, of the 23 million, a couple of million had to go to just being public. I mean, it costs a lot of money to stay public.
That is an exact that we fully agree with. We were compelled to look at ways to raise investment. Being in Australia, the private equity market after the global downturn just completely changed. There were only one or two investors active in the healthcare space, particularly biotechs at early stage, were very difficult to raise the sort of funding that we needed. We simply wouldn't have raised the $23 million over the course of our journey if we hadn't gone public. Way back then, when I spoke to investment banks in the States, the recent JP Morgan conference was on in January this year. That's held annually. And a lot of the feedback came, you need to be public to raise money in the States. So we did. We created a Delaware entity. We put all the shareholders into that Delaware entity. And we have a private, wholly owned operating subsidiary here in Melbourne, Australia, that carries all our tax losses. We file our tax returns in the United States. So we may be operating here, and our principal place of operations is here in Australia. But being a US entity really enabled us to raise money through hedge funds and through trading up our shares in a public forum, albeit the OTC, far more than what we would have if we remained private in Australia.
So the cost of being public is just the cost of doing business. But being public has been very instrumental in helping you raise capital. That's what you're saying?
Absolutely, it has. We wouldn't have been able to raise the sort of hedge fund money. It's expensive funding, but it's taken us to a point. We've always taken a long-term view, and it's a flexible view. We recognize that at early stage, we didn't have our patents in place. We didn't have proof of concept in animals, which we now have. We have research partnerships globally with two universities in Spain. We've spent a lot of money developing the manufacturing side of our drug that has us now ready to start our first clinical trial within the next 6 to 9 months after we complete this next financing. We simply wouldn't have achieved it. We've had some amazing successes along the way. At one stage, we were the most traded stock on the OTC in the middle of last decade. We understand now, as a result of the pandemic, all of that has changed. A lot of companies have caught up, even OTC companies, about the way they need to market their stock. And so, again, we're needing to change, understand, and be nimble, and look to raise that next funding, because we believe it's going to really change the fortunes of the company for the long term, but in the near term.
Are your rounds going up in price? Are every time you sell a round, are they going higher as you bleed out the risk?
We probably can't answer that at this point in time. The structures that we've had to rely on, our largest round going back a few years was a $4.75 million debenture, senior secured. That sort of funding now just doesn't occur on the OTC anymore. Those types of investments aren't around. So the sort of Series A that we're looking for is a more traditional type of Series A with a blue chip investor that can understand we're still relatively early stage. But as we move forward into clinical trials with such a novel mechanism of action, with the results that we're hoping for, we think that this could really obtain traction very quickly in the marketplace.
Tell us, financial issues aside, where are the big risks?
There's always technical risks, regulatory risks. So you really need to do your homework, understand your technology, not take any shortcuts, bring in the best, most experienced people available, look at ways to examine all the different aspects of your drug. And we've done a good portion of that. But a lot of the value that we've generated to this point has been below the surface. Everybody waits for that first lot of human data to say, wow, and suddenly you're hailed as an overnight success. But what it takes is a number of years leading up to it to make sure you've done all the right steps to know that what you're testing in your clinical trial, you're confident that all the variables are in place to test it accurate.
Has anybody ever asked you, in this world of fraud, and we had FTX, the crypto thing that was a fraud, we had Theranos that was a fraud. Has anybody ever asked you, how do we know that this is real?
Oh, particularly in the early days, a lot of people see OTC companies as garage operations. We don't think of ourselves as that. We think of ourselves as a diamond in the rough. So one might see coal, but a little bit of polishing, I think we could prove to be a diamond. But we know so many successful companies, we don't need to name them, that have started as garage operators.
Yeah. No, listen, I know there's been a lot of great ones, but people are always worried about stepping on the next booby trap. So how do people know? Yes. How do they know that this is really a real thing with real data, with real information, with real whatever? I mean, how do they do due diligence if they're not a technical person?
That's an excellent question. It comes down to the ethics and the accuracy of what you say out to the marketplace that really is important. Every single word that you put out there, you have to recognize it's a fine line between what you say regarding the belief that you have in your technology and the hope that you have for cancer patients in the longer term, and you explain it as fact. Understand what the facts are that are drawn from the scientific data that you produce. My number one is to communicate in a language that anybody can pick up and understand. So if they look at my press releases, they look at what I write, what I post in LinkedIn, I like to think that people either can understand what I'm saying, or if it's not understood, that the definition behind it, that gives them an understanding of what we're trying to communicate. And I always try to stay on point with what we say, because the facts are there to speak for themselves. But this isn't a technology looking for a market. This is something that we specifically chose because it has a scientific rationale behind it. It's just a lot of the science that we've now uncovered has proven to be something of interest for a lot of companies and physicians because of the advancement that cancer treatments have made over the last 20 years. Still more to be done.
Are you in a position to speculate on what's possible for this company?
I always think that I like to be careful, but the first and foremost objective of ours is to get this drug into patients possible. Works, get it to as many patients as possible. It's as simple as that. Now, if we achieve that, then the success of the company will follow as the benefit. That's my goal, because when it comes right down to it, it's what motivates a CEO to put themselves through the struggles that they do every day. For me, it's about legacy. It's helping someone's mother, someone's father, someone's son or daughter who is affected. So, and we all are. We all are. You don't have to ask the room, has anyone been affected by cancer? We all have. And that's what motivates me every day.
When you are raising capital, do you have any kind of discussion with the money about whether they're going to be patient enough and give you the space to do this ethically, honestly, and take as much time as it needs? Because sometimes the money kind of forces the CEO to move a little faster than might be prudent.
That's a great question. But if you're honest and direct, so that you set what those timelines are, then really there should be no misunderstanding. And what I communicated when we did that $4.75 million debenture, we had milestones as part of the financing. We hit on time and on budget our milestones that we did for that $4.75 million debenture. Unfortunately, that institutional investor was unraveled for a number of different reasons, being a big investor in OTC. The regulatory environment has changed over the last 5 to 10 years with regards to OTC. And so that was a challenge. They were meant to do a follow-on round. So we're looking for that next investor that will have a similar understanding. We communicate up front what the goals and the milestones are. We give them realistic timeframes, and we think they're achievable. It's as simple as that. Be honest, be upfront, and direct.
Are you dealing with any family offices, or was it mostly hedge funds and private equity outfits?
At the moment, it's been largely private equity and hedge money, those sort of things.
I'll tell you, it seems to me like the family office business would be really ripe for this.
Oh, I agree. I would love to tap into as far wide a net as I can, because we're virtually ready to on the ground floor. Valuation that we think could really be attractive for an investor who's motivated like we are to get something to market as possible.
Well, it's pretty fascinating. So, what's the rollout? Once you get the FDA, that's in the United States, but you're in Australia. Tell us about how that process works. How do you get the regulators to say yes? Go to the next step. Just tell us a little bit about how it works.
Again, it comes down to communication, doing all the right work up front, and then approaching the regulators at the right time. So we've done that already. We had prior human experience with our drug through compassionate use. As I mentioned before, enzyme treatments have been around for nearly 100 years. But never to the level that we've taken it. Now, there were a number of patients that were treated by my colleague and chief scientific officer in the UK and Australia, but they were predominantly UK patients. So we started having meetings with the UK regulatory agency called the MHRA. We've had a number of scientific advice meetings with them. We've also made submissions to the FDA and also the European Medicines Agency. So For our lead indication that we've selected, we're targeting pancreatic cancer. Pancreatic cancer is an orphan drug indication. Now, what that means is if a target patient population is under 150,000 patients, you can get 7 years market exclusivity. Plus, you get discounts on your fees associated with the regulatory agencies and also some research and development assistance advice. We obtained orphan drug designation status from the US FDA in 2017 for the treatment of pancreatic cancer. So this means we will have 7 years market exclusivity where no one can replicate our drug during that period to encourage investment in these small market indications.
And when does the 7 year clock start running?
It starts running once your drug is approved.
So you're still a couple of years away from that happening.
That's right. And so these are examples by which you work with the regulatory agencies at the right time. So globally, what we'll be doing, we may do our initial early stage trials in Australia, but we will do it to the right international standards that we can then start to present that data and have our pre-IND meeting with the FDA, have our meetings with the European Medicines Agency. All of these things are planned as part of your discipline of pharmaceutical drug development. It comes with the territory. You have to understand your process. You have to be prepared. You have to apply a high level of scientific rigor and then demand the standards that you need to meet with the regulatory agencies. Normally, US FDA orphan drug designation is assigned to companies that are already in clinical trials. But the reason that we were able to achieve this designation status from the FDA because of our prior human experience with our drug through the compassionate use. Now, that wouldn't have happened if we didn't evaluate those patients, get them independently assessed, put the clinical reports, and we've even published that data. On our website, we have our scientific publications, we publish our preclinical data, we have our patents which are public, and all of that requires the same sort of level of effort and discipline in terms of managing IP and managing the drug development process to get your drug through the various stages.
Tell us a little bit about the governance structure of your company, the board of directors. How do you, you know, I'm not talking about your operating structure, but your governance up above that. How does it work?
Right now, we're lean and mean. So we have two directors, including myself, and a third non-executive director. Now, we've deliberately stayed small with a view that bringing in the right investment for this Series A, and then hopefully as part of an uplisting transaction, we understand that we'll need to expand and provide the resources we need to maintain NASDAQ or, you know, exchange compliance. So as of today, we don't necessarily have all the segregation of duties that are normally associated with an exchange listed company, but we apply a high level of discipline within our company and structure at the moment. So our non-executive director has an accounting and auditing and a compliance background. My chief scientific officer is a medic, a physician, and a clinician, a scientist. And myself, I have a regulatory background as well as pharmaceutical development. And so between us, we overlap in terms of segregation of duties, but we all have specific areas that we have oversight within the company framework and with our outsourced partners.
So let me... You know, I ask all of our guests this question as we start to wind up here. I always want to know what the advantage play is. What's the killer strategy that's going to make your company successful? I heard a couple of things that I really liked. I just want to hear from you. What do you think your killer strategy is?
When it comes down to it, fundamentally, at the core of this company is belief in the product. That's how we differentiate ourselves. And what I mean by that is, how many oncology drugs make it through from early stage development through to authorization? Now, that's a rhetorical that I don't expect you to know. About 5%. Now, what if we said we have a technology that has prior patient experience And just to relay a short story, we met with the senior medical oncologist at the Peter Mac Cancer Centre here in Melbourne. And he said, you know how many first-in-human studies I've done? I said, no. He said, 20. He asked me, how many of them worked? I responded, 3. He said, none. So then I asked him the genuine question, how many of those companies had prior human experience with their drug? His eyes went wide open, and he agreed to bring his pancreatic and ovarian cancer specialists the next meeting, and we discussed what we need to have ready to start our first. The point of the story is he is acutely aware that most drugs will fail 3/4 on the basis of safety. But if we have a drug with human experience already, 100 years behind it, we already have done all the safety tests, all the animal studies, we've gone through, not cut any corners, spent the last 15 years building the IP and the knowledge, reinvestigating how this all works, we believe that we have changed the numbers in our favor. We believe this drug works. And that fundamentally is what differentiates us from most technologies that are looking for markets.
Well, listen, the name of the show, Your Advantage Play, is really all about those killer strategies and people who deliver on the promise of the show, which means, kind of unraveling for us, they're, kind of uncovering their advantage play. We call those people advantage players, and that makes you an advantage player. And we appreciate you being on the show and sharing with us. And listen, we're all rooting for you to be successful because we all need you to be successful. So thank you for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Joel.
You've been listening to Your Advantage Play with your host, Joel Block. To learn more about how to work with Joel and cultivate your own high-limit advantage plays, visit theadvantageplayer.com. Subscribe to Your Advantage Play wherever you get your podcasts.
How about a shout out and a huge thanks to our podcast show producer, David Wolf, and the team at Autovita Studios. Profit from the inside wouldn't be possible without these wonderful professionals. To learn more or to find out how you can launch and produce your own podcast show, reach out to www.audivita.com. That's audivita.com. How about a shout out and a huge thanks to our podcast show producer, David Wolf, and the team at Autovita Studios. Profit from the inside wouldn't be possible without these wonderful professionals. To learn more or to find out how you can launch and produce your own podcast show, reach out to www.audivita.com. That's audivita.com.